Well, I'll be honest, they're not the best terms for everybody else. They definitely talked about, you know, what it looks like for future rounds and their investment and their dilution and whatnot. But they also recognize that a small piece of something is better than a big piece of nothing. You know, Shark Tank is an investment in your business that might not, on an economic level, on a blind taste test, be the best thing that you ever had. But the exposure and the opportunity and then also the collaboration of having those sharks, that in itself is worth so much more than the equity they gave up. And at the end of the day, the person who lost the most equity is me. That was 15% of my baby. You know, y'all got 2% here and 8% there. I used to have 100%.
Okay.
It was 100% all of me before y'all got here. And I've been allowing people to whittle away at my pie throughout this journey. But I'm willing to do that because I recognize that even if I walk away with 12% of this, but we sell it for $100 million, I'm going to make a lot more than I would at some corporate sales job at Oracle. No offense to Oracle. They use my app and I love Oracle a lot. But I don't want to be an SDR at Oracle. I want to build an app that Oracle uses for their employees and I get paid to do so. And I'm willing to make those caveats.
Talk to us about the app itself. What does it do?
Yeah, so Cardio is a gamified movement app. It turns your outdoor walking and running into a giant team game of turf war. So let's say that you're walking around UT's campus and you're on Team UT. As you walk around all the buildings and schools and all these other areas around campus, you would track your mile pace, your distance, your calories, your route, the locations and landmarks you move past. But that area, almost like a game of capture flag, would be captured for your team by you moving through it. Other teams, let's say Texas A&M, for instance. If a person from Texas A&M decided to make the drive from College Station and do a run around UT's campus, they would steal UT's campus from Team UT. Whoever walked that area before them would get notified, oh, this person stole this area from you, and the only way to get it back is to go out there, walk, run, crawl, cartwheel, whatever it is that you want to do to move. And the idea is to add this layer of social dynamicism and gamification on top of the outdoor walking and running that people should be doing to hopefully make it a more enjoyable experience for them. Like I said, the idea of it was if Pokemon Go was a running app.
Obviously, there's been some highs. Talk to us about the lows and getting to where you are right now.
I mean, I used to live in my car and eat peanut butter out of a spoon, man. Like, I was paying for an extended stay hotel of $60 a day, and I was paying by the day. So, I mean, there was a lot of moments. I mean, even when I was on Shark Tank, we only had $2 in the bank account because we hadn't received some funding yet from some investors that we had closed deals on. So I was out there with the confidence of a made man with $1.92 in his bank account. I actually had to get somebody to cash at me money to have a celebratory dinner the next day because I didn't have it because I was investing all that money into the business. I had no money for myself. So there was a lot of struggle that's going to come. It's not over. We're on the 20-yard line. A lot of people talking to me like I'm a made man because I was on TV. But, you know, we're on the 20-yard line. We got a long way to go before we get to the end zone.
Dustin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kuch.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kuch.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
I love what I do, and a lot of people look up to me and, you know, want to do what I do, and I always tell them, like, yo, it's worth it if you're strong enough. How many people are willing to look a six-figure guaranteed bi-weekly check with great health insurance, 9-to-5, work-life balance, friends, something stable, and say, I would forego all of that to build something, be broke the whole time I'm doing it for a maybe chance that it works out. A maybe chance. Most people don't want to do that, or they think they do, and when they hit their first roadblock, I got a lot of friends and a lot of people who I've met along the journey. I've been working on this pretty much for the better part of 3 years now, and I've had a lot of people who had more money, who had more pedigree, who had better experience, who had better connections, who did not make it as far as I did because they hit their first roadblock. We ran out of money, or I can't find an engineer to join my team at a price I can afford, or none of these investors are biting on this, or this, and that, you know, and they give up.
Dustin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. Becoming an entrepreneur, one has to identify a niche that aligns with their interests and market needs and create a comprehensive business plan. In 2020, the inspiration behind the fitness app was born. Struggling with cardio workouts after graduating from the University of Kentucky during the COVID-19 pandemic, Bell knew he had to do something. This realization prompted him to create an app that would transform a dull exercise into something fun. Cardio is a fitness app turning your outdoor walking and running into a giant team game of turf war. As you track your walks and runs, you claim that area of town with your team, and you can steal or defend it from others walking and running individuals and clubs in your city. Recently, Bell pitched his gamified movement app company in Shark Tank Season 16, Episode 1. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Cardio with co-founder and CEO Dustin G. Bell, Part 2, In Black America.
You know, I had several different tiers of how I thought about it. The first tier was just to get on and make good TV. Because one thing that people don't know about Shark Tank also is that there are 160-ish companies, maybe even more than that, that actually go and film. And only about 80 of them will actually make TV. So beyond the process of how difficult it is to even get to the point where you film Shark Tank, to actually get on TV is also like another 50-50. It's a flip of a coin if you're even going to make TV. So my first focus, going back to why I counted at 10%, even though I was cool with 15%, is just to make good television, because I didn't expect to get a deal, or if I did, I didn't think it was going to be a deal I liked or from a shark that I wanted. So I wanted to just make sure that no matter what happens, we're just going to air. The episode is going to make it to TV.
With limited job opportunities after graduating from the University of Kentucky during the pandemic, Dustin G. Bell found himself sleeping on the couch in his father's attic and losing motivation to work out or engage in outdoor cardio. During this time, he came up with an idea for a fitness software. After reflecting on how Pokemon Go gained popularity and demonstrated that those who would not have normally been outside were more willing to do so in a gamified way. Fast forward, he decided to pack up his belongings and move to Austin, Texas, without a job, family, or place to stay. Bear was recently featured in the first episode of Season 16 of Shark Tank. He asked the Sharks for $150,000 in exchange for 5% equity in his company, valued it at $3 million. He secured a deal for $150,000 in exchange for 15% equity in his company. Of course, after this episode aired, the company gained a lot of attention and more people started using the Cardio app. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Justin G. Bell in studio. So when you came up with the idea, obviously one has to make the app. So who are part of your team?
Yeah, a lot of people. So the funny part is that I talk to people all the time. They're like, yo, how'd you go about executing on this? You know, what skills did you have? What experience did you have? I had none. You know, I'm not an engineer. I went to school for marketing, so I didn't know how to build apps. I never designed apps. I had no money. I was not a runner, so I didn't have a vast experience with running apps. I had never led a team of engineers. I also had no money because I was basically making enough to survive. So it was definitely not enough for me to pay, you know, $10,000 a month for engineers. So I sent a ton of DMs. I sent about 400 DMs over a 3-ish month span to a
What's
bunch
a DM?
Of yeah. Oh, my a direct message. That's what the kids.
Okay.
The kids
right.
Get you. But a direct message to a bunch of engineers on LinkedIn, asking them to, hey, basically quit your job and work with me for free. And all of them said no, obviously, because they're not, you know, idiots. So they all said no. But one of them, you know, connected me with the founder of Pokemon Go. So I reached out to him, sent him a message. He responded. And then long story short, we ended up getting a $50K investment from him and his team at Pokemon Go. And then with that, I was able to then convince my CTO to quit his job. Funny enough, he was working at LinkedIn, DM on LinkedIn, got him to leave LinkedIn through LinkedIn. It's funny, but got him to quit his job. And then he worked with me and he's the person who built the original app.
You recently was profiled on the first episode of season 16 for Shark Tank. Talk to us, one, why did you want to be on the program and how was that process?
Yeah, well, first off, why I wanted to be on, I mean, it's Shark Tank. You know, it's the Super Bowl of being an entrepreneur.
Okay.
Everybody wants to be on Shark Tank. Millions of people see your business. It blows up your brand. It makes you feel more official. And it's also just good for your company. People buy your stuff. They download your app. They recognize you and become a brand in yourself. And I always felt like growing up watching the show, I felt like I would kill it in that. I'm confident. I love to talk. And I'm witty. And I always knew as a kid I wanted to be on it. And then 16 years old, I told my mom, I'm going to be on this show. And when I am, I'm going to bring you on it with me. And so flash forward a decade, because I was 16, I'm 26 now. Flash forward a decade. Funny enough, this is another thing that people don't know. I didn't even apply to be on Shark Tank. Somebody from Shark Tank reached out to me and asked, hey, man, I saw you on somewhere. He didn't even remember where he said he saw me, but he saw me somewhere and said, yeah, I like this kid. I like his app. I like his energy. I like his persona. I think he'd be good on camera. I think he'd be a fun guy to have on. And so he reached out to me. I initially thought it was a scam because, you know, just why would somebody reach out to me? It's like, you know, the prom queen reaching out to like the wallflower nerd and asking him to dance. You know, that's not how this works. It's supposed to be the other way around, you know? So I didn't believe it. But then after I did my due diligence, realized he was legit, reached out back to him. We had a chat. He expedited me through the application process. That in itself was, you know, several months of back and forth on things I needed to get approved from legal, getting the app ready, preparing the pitch, thinking about who I needed to pitch to, what I needed to say. So it was a process. It was not easy. It was not always fun. But finally we got on. We filmed the episode back in June. And then, you know, obviously we closed the deal with two sharks. That was awesome, getting Damon John and then another guy, Rashawn Williams, guest shark, but awesome dude, you know, early investor in Coinbase, DoorDash, Lyft, minority owner for the Atlanta Falcons. Both very successful, powerful black men who I look up to. So getting them to be, you know, part of this journey with me and give me advice and the money, of course, was a great opportunity for me. And then, you know, now that the episode is out, we were on the season premiere. We were the headline pitch of the season. People still tell me to this day, they see my face on commercials on ABC during college game day and stuff like that, because they've been running my episode as part of their advertising campaign for the season. You know, it's a very surreal feeling, and it was something that I envisioned for almost a decade up to that point. So actually having it happen and it being such a big success was, you know, dream come true.
Now, prior to that, when you went on the program, was there amount of money that you was looking for versus equity in your company?
Yeah, so, you know, the main thing that they make you do on Shark Tank, of course, is pitch and say, I want this much money for this percentage of my company, right? So I went in there initially asking for $150,000 for 5%. Now, the thing is, I've watched a lot of Shark Tank in my day, John, and I knew going into it, I was not going to get the number that I asked for.
Right.
I just knew that. So I came in asking for 150 at 5. I knew I wasn't going to get it. I actually wanted like 150 at 10 or 15. And I knew if I asked for that up front, they was going to walk me down at 20, 25. So I knew, let's start at 5. They might say 25. I'll meet them at
15. Work your way to 15, guys.
Now, what was funny about it is that they initially countered 150 at 15% immediately. Now, the thing is, that was the number I wanted. And so I immediately wanted to be like, deal, we're done. It's over. Bye. But I realized, all right, we got to make good television. So I counted. I made a fake counter. I didn't even care. I'm like, what about 10%? And it was so funny. Like, Mark Cuban lost his mind. Oh, Destin, no. Oh, you blew him. You know, Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, he's killing me. He's like, oh, your mom's watching the episode right now saying you should have took the deal, bozo, and And I'm not going to lie, I was freaking out. They did a really good job of cutting me to look good. As the kids say, I would have lost a little bit of aura because I, unfortunately, freaked out a little bit. I will acknowledge. I'm like, whoa, hey, my bad. You know, I'm about 17.5%, 20%. You know, I feel bad. But, you know, we ended up coming to a really good deal at 150 at 15%. And, you know, getting a buy one, get one for Sharks is a deal I like. I used to get buy one, get one Twix bars at, you know, Family Dollar. I think buy one, get one for Sharks is a lot better. So I'm happy with the deal I make.
Now, when you look at the deal that you make, obviously the money is important, but also advertising your brand and having access to these two individuals is worth more than what they gave you.
Oh, exponentially. $150,000 in the grand scheme of things isn't a lot of money. You know, we had already raised about $300,000 the same month that we went on that show. So the money was never the biggest thing. You know, I had several different tiers of how I thought about it. The first tier was just to get on and make good TV. Because one thing that people don't know about Shark Tank also is that there are 160-ish companies, maybe even more than that, that actually go in film. And only about 80 of them will actually make TV. So beyond the process of how difficult it is to even get to the point where you film Shark Tank, to actually get on TV is also like another 50-50. It's a flip of a coin if you're even going to make TV. So my first focus, going back to why I counted at 10%, even though I was cool with 15, is just to make good television. Because I didn't expect to get a deal, or if I did, I didn't think it was going to be a deal I liked or from a shark that I wanted. So I wanted to just make sure that no matter what happens, we're just going to air. The episode is going to make it to TV. And then the second was, of course, to get a deal. You know, I want a deal. I want good terms. I want to be sharks who can be valuable to the company. And then the third one was get my mom to be on TV with me, which I don't know if we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I was able to finesse that one at the end. But, you know, they're way more important than just the money that they got. And I mean, even off of that, I've had so many people reach out to me independently. I've had people who wanted me to do speaking engagements and gigs, talk to their students, mentor them. I've had people, you know, pay for me to do those things, which has never happened to me before. And then on top of that, you know, for the business, it was great. You know, we got thousands of downloads within a day, and then we just kept that momentum running. Even now, it's been like almost 3 weeks since the episode aired, and we're still seeing these residual tailwinds. We had people from CNBC and Forbes and Blavity and Afrotech and all these different places reach out to us, want to use our app, got all these new opportunities from it. I mean, just across the board, it has been a huge opportunity beyond getting the money and getting the sharks, just being on TV, and then not only having those two people give us money, but then also make phone calls on my behalf, connect me to people, and then put their brand with mine to make me look more legit. And when I reach out to people, instead of them leaving me on red, they call me. It's a very solid feeling. It feels great.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're streaming with Dustin George Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. Talk to us about having your mom on television.
Yeah, my mom is a really important person to me. You know, when I was growing up, I wasn't always as polished as I presented you today,
yes,
John.
Sir. Yes, sir.
it took me a little bit. You know, I had a lot of smoothing out on the edges over the years, and my mother was one of the very first people to invest in me, because a lot of people saw me as a troublemaker, bad grades, cut school, get in fights, get suspended at school, all these different types of things that I did when I was younger. My mom always saw past that, you know, he's different. You know, he's not a school, he's not an academic, he doesn't care about things he doesn't care about. He's not good at homework, but he's a smart kid. He's not good at listening, but he's good at talking. And she invested in the things that I was really good at. And, you know, when I was 16, like I said, you know, my mom, me and her were watching Shark Tank every week. I used to have a really bad lisp and a stutter. I wasn't a very good public speaker back then. And my mother told me at a young age that a guy like you who wants to talk as much as he does needs to be good at it. And one of the things that we did to improve my speaking was watch Shark Tank. That was the reason we started watching it. Even before I was really legitimately interested in business, we would watch Shark Tank just so I could learn how to present my ideas succinctly, charismatically, persuasively, and all that type of stuff. And when I was 16, I said, yo, I actually want to be on this show. I made the decision I want to be on it. Me and my mom, we were locked in. Every time I've done a business event, my mother has, to the best of her ability, always supported it. Whether it was $50 to do this, or it was her flying to Austin to help me with that, or if it was me calling her at 1 a.m. and asking, yo, mom, what do you think about this? My mom has always been there for me. So when it came time for me to actually be on Shark Tank, I made sure to the best of my ability that she would be there. Now, here's the funny part. Shark Tank was actually extremely against it at first, because they said you can only be on with people who are equity partners in your business. I know she's your mom and she's your rock and she's your confidant and your pseudo chief of staff, but she's not actually, so she can't come. So when we flew, because we flew to L.A. to film the episode, when we flew to L.A., they told me that she couldn't come unless we paid for her out of pocket. So I'm like, screw it. So we paid for her. And then at first they're like, leave her at the hotel. And I said, oh, well, could I bring her to the green room with me at least? I don't want her to just be waiting. I could be here for hours. And I said, okay, fine. She can come to the green room. And then when we get to the green room, I'm like, oh, but wouldn't it be cool if before the episode started, she was with me in the lobby. We give a little prayer. We hug each other. We say some kind words. You know, it's a family show. It's a family business type deal. And like, that's actually a great idea. Let's get makeup, hair. Let's put some cardio gear on her. Yeah. And then as I go in there, if you watch the episode, I was planting the seeds. Again, my first goal, make good TV. My second goal, get some money. Third goal, get my mom on TV. So one and two were going pretty good. But throughout the process, I was like, all right, I need to sprinkle my mom in here. Mm-hmm. So when Lori, one of the other sharks on the show, Lori was out very early, and I just threw in, oh, by the way, Lori, my mom says you're her favorite shark. All you guys are tied for second, but Lori, you're her favorite. Oh, that's cute. Then later, when they asked, like, you know, what's your why? Why are you here? Why do you want to do this? I'm like, oh, well, you know, my mother, I want to create generational wealth. I want to be able to provide for her and my kids and anybody else and my family who's been there for me. And my mom is back there right now waiting for me to get a deal, and I'm not leaving without one. And like, oh. And then they said, oh, 15%. I'm like, ooh, can I ask my mom what she thinks about it? And then they say, oh, well, go get your mom. Go get your mom. Bring her in the tank. Let's see. Let's ask her directly. So I said, and they cut this part, but I literally said, oh, bleep. Like, for real? I broke character for a moment. And then I got to bring her out on the Shark Tank. You know, everybody got to see her and talk to her. And, you know, we got to have that big moment where we embrace and talk to each other. And, you know, we got to hug Damon and Rashawn together, take some group photos. It was an awesome experience. It was honestly a dream come true. I think that was honestly more meaningful to me than getting a deal and being on TV was getting to do it with my mom.
I heard that. Dustin, before we run out of time, how does the deal with Shark Tank affect your other investors?
Well, I'll be honest, they're not the best terms for everybody else. They definitely talked about, you know, what it looks like for future rounds and their investment and their dilution and whatnot. But they also recognize that a small piece of something is better than a big piece of nothing. You know, Shark Tank is an investment in your business that might not, on an economic level, on a blind taste test, be the best thing that you ever had. But the exposure and the opportunity and then also the collaboration of having those sharks, that in itself is worth so much more than the equity they gave up. And at the end of the day, the person who lost the most equity is me. That was 15% of my baby. You know, y'all got 2% here and 8% there. I used to have 100%.
Okay.
It was 100% all of me before y'all got here. And I've been allowing people to whittle away at my pie throughout this journey. But I'm willing to do that because I recognize that even if I walk away with 12% of this, but we sell it for $100 million, I'm going to make a lot more than I would at some corporate sales job at Oracle. No offense to Oracle. They use my app and I love Oracle a lot. But I don't want to be an SDR at Oracle. I want to build an app that Oracle uses for their employees and I get paid to do so. And, I'm willing to make those caveats.
Talk to us about the app itself. What does it do?
Yeah, so Cardio is a gamified movement app. It turns your outdoor walking and running into a giant team game of turf war. So let's say that you're walking around UT's campus and you're on Team UT. As you walk around all the buildings and schools and all these other areas around campus, you would track your mile pace, your distance, your calories, your route, the locations and landmarks you move past. But that area, almost like a game of capture flag, would be captured for your team by you moving through it. Other teams, let's say Texas A&M, for instance. If a person from Texas A&M decided to make the drive from College Station and do a run around UT's campus, they would steal UT's campus from Team UT. Whoever walked that area before them would get notified, oh, this person stole this area from you, and the only way to get it back, so go out there, walk, run, crawl, cartwheel, whatever it is that you want to do to move. And the idea is to add this layer of social dynamicism and gamification on top of the outdoor walking and running that people should be doing to hopefully make it a more enjoyable experience for them. Like I said, the idea of it was if Pokemon Go was a running app.
Obviously, there's been some highs. Talk to us about the lows and getting to where you are right now.
Man, I used to live in my car and eat peanut butter out of a spoon, man. Like, I was paying for an extended stay hotel of $60 a day, and I was paying by the day.
Okay.
So, I mean, there was a lot of moments. I mean, even when I was on Shark Tank, we only had $2 in the bank account because we hadn't received some funding yet from some investors that we had closed deals on. So I was out there with the confidence of a made man with $1.92 in his bank account. I actually had to get somebody to cash at me money to have a celebratory dinner the next day. Because I didn't have it, because I was investing all that money into the business. I had no money for myself. So there was a lot of struggle that's going to come. It's not over. We're on the 20-yard line. A lot of people talking to me like I'm a made man because I was on TV. But, you know, we're on the 20-yard line. We got a long way to go before we get to the end zone. And there will be more tough times ahead. There was plenty behind me. But, you know, like I said, I love the game. So I don't really care. I was built for it.
Long term, where you see yourself and the company 5-10 years down the road?
5-10 years down the road, I would like to say I've already sold it for a sizable amount of money. Okay. I'll roll that money over for a nice sabbatical and treat my lady to a much needed vacation. But honestly, for myself, I just see myself keep doing this over and over again until eventually I have a wife and kids and they tell me I gotta hang it up. You know, I don't think cardio is going to be the biggest thing I ever do. I think this is not my Tesla or SpaceX. This is like Zip 2. A lot of people don't even know what Zip 2 is, but it was Elon's first major win all the way back in 95 and 99. He made a bunch of money off it. Nobody even remembers it because in the grand scheme of all the things he did afterward, you know, it was small things. It was a very, very small thing. I would like to say that in 5 to 10 years, Shark Tank won't even be in the top 10 accomplishments of my life. I won't even mention it unless it's something like, oh yeah, that old thing. That's where I would like to be in my life.
When you look back at where you are today, how did the Von Altman School Entrepreneur Center get you to where you are and get you to thinking in that mindset?
Oh, the Von Altman Center is amazing. You know, I was a very young, wide-eyed kid. I didn't know much. You know, I didn't even know what entrepreneurship was. I had called hustling my whole life. I never even knew that there was a word. And it took me forever to be able to spell it. I don't even know if I can spell it now properly without a little bit of help. But at that time, you know, I was just going around campus and trying to talk to all the professors and people I could talk to. And the thing is, a lot of people, when I talk to them about being an entrepreneur, especially as a scrappy kid who doesn't know much, he just got wide eyes and he might not actually be able to follow through with it. A lot of people didn't take me very seriously. Like, ah, he's just talking. He's not ready to do this. They were one of the few groups that initially were like, yo, okay, this is what you want to do. They gave me this book called The Lean Startup. And they said, you know what, if you serious, here's this book. It's like 300 pages. It's all about startups. Read it. I read it in like a week, came back to them with a full report on like what I learned from it, how I was going to activate on it. They said, okay, this kid's not playing around. And they gave me my first funding. It, mind you, it wasn't a lie. It was $250 mm-hmm. for my first college company, the one I mentioned, the marketing company. But at the time, $250 was a lot of money to me. I was making like $8 an hour, so that was about 30 hours of work for me, so I was a lot of money at the time. And, you know, all the mentorship and opportunity and really just belief. Everybody always talks about money and they talk about opportunities and all these things that are required to be a great entrepreneur, but I think really the main thing you need from people is just belief, like genuine belief, not like, oh yeah, you could accomplish it maybe, sort of, and they don't really care and they don't invest in that, but more so like somebody who legitimately puts their neck on the line to say that I endorse this kid. I think he's solid. I think that he has something and I'm willing to invest in him. I'm willing to put my life, my neck on the line, you know, to co-sign him and give him the opportunities that people like him typically don't get. And they were one of the very first groups to do that. So, I mean, I always have a lot of love and respect for those guys.
Talk to us about the commitment one has to have when your effort is dependent on what you do that day to support yourself.
I talk to a lot of people who want to be entrepreneurs. Some younger than me, some older than me, some from different backgrounds, wealthy, even poorer than mine, all that type of stuff, right? And they always say, I want to do this, I want to do that. I'm like, look, man, I love what I do. And a lot of people look up to me and, you know, want to do what I do. And I always tell them, like, yo, it's worth it if you're strong enough. Mm-hmm. How many people are willing to look a six-figure guaranteed biweekly check with great health insurance, 9-to-5 work-life balance, friends, something stable, and say, I would forego all of that to build something, be broke the whole time I'm doing it for a maybe chance that mm-hmm. it works out. A maybe chance. Most people don't want to do that, or they think they do. And when they hit their first roadblock, I got a lot of friends and a lot of people who I've met along the journey. I've been working on this pretty much for the better part of 3 years now. And I've had a lot of people who had more money, who had more pedigree, who had better experience, who had better connections, who did not make it as far as I did because they hit their first roadblock. We ran out of money. Or I can't find an engineer to join my team at a price I can afford. Or none of these investors are biting on this. Or this, and that. You know, and they give up. And you know, the only thing I could ever tell anybody is that if you love this game, you genuinely gotta love it. You can't love the outcome. You gotta love the journey. If you're doing this because you want to fly on a private jet and get to party with Damon John and da da da, that's not gonna happen. Or if it does happen, it's gonna take many, many, many years. I'm a lucky man in a lot of ways that things have happened for me as quickly as they did. But, you know, for a lot of people, they are starving entrepreneurs for a very, very long time. And you got to love working on this more than you enjoy going on vacation. I've only been on one vacation the last like 5 years. And my mom kind of forced me to even do that when I was working part of the time I was there. But, you know, you got to love it more than vacation. You got to love it more than dating. You got to love it more than a nice car. You got to love it more than the respect of your peers. You got to love it more than sleep. You got to love it more than good food. You don't have to eat peanut butter out of a jar with a spoon sometimes. If you're willing to do that, then, I mean, it's for you. And if you're not, then hopefully you don't have to. I pray for anybody who wants to do this that it don't come to that, because it wasn't always great for me. It was a very tough time, physically, mentally, emotionally, definitely financially. I love the game enough to suffer for it.
How do you go about selecting your team? I found it interesting in some of the research that I did prior to this conversation that when you interview people, it's not about interviewing them for, yes, the job that you want them to perform, but they need, you all need to be compatible.
Oh, yeah. I like to describe, and I try to say this in the nicest way possible, I would describe being co-founders in an early stage startup like marriage without makeup sex. Because unfortunately, business is not always going to be good. We're going to run out of money. I'm going to screw up. You're going to screw up. We're going to be misaligned. You know, it's great when money's flowing and everything's going well and nothing is broken in the app and users are flocking in and all that. But then there are moments when you run out of money or you're not seeing the growth that you want. And it's like, well, is it my fault? Is it your fault? Well, you didn't build this thing fast enough. Well, you didn't make these TikToks. You didn't run your ass this way. You didn't. And you just have to sit there and deal with that. On top of that, there's all these different things that you don't even think about. Like, what happens if we run out of money? Can you afford to not have a salary for 6 months? If you get married, is your spouse going to support doing something unstable like this? Do you go out every other night? Do I go out every night? Maybe I might be resentful of the fact that you out in the club at 2 a.m. while I'm sending emails and writing code. You know, you really got to know who you're getting married with, because being in a business marriage, which is basically what it is, is difficult. And there's not a lot of ways you can make up for that. In normal relationships, there's a lot of things that you can do momentarily to lay off a little bit. But with business, that just doesn't happen. You know, there's not a lot of ways that you can smooth over a relationship in business if you guys are just not aligned on the same things. And I've had to deal with that before, and I probably will have to deal with it in the future. But, you know, it's a very difficult thing, and that's why finding a good team member is so difficult. But if you do, it's so impactful.
What can they find the app?
You can find us on the iOS App Store. Unfortunately, we are not on Android yet. So for my green text bubblers out there, I am working on it, promise you. I get yelled at about that a lot. I'm working on it. But for my iOS people, look us up. It's Cardio, which is CARD.io. So it's card.io. You can find it that way. You can also find us online on our website, which is downloadcard.io. You can go there for my Android folks. There's a wait list that you can sign up for. I would be very happy to have you, and I promise I will work on getting you an app very, very, very soon. I mean, you can also find me on Instagram. Just look me up, Destin George Bell. You should find me. I got decent SEO on that name. And then also on LinkedIn, I would love to connect, chat with anybody who wants to talk business, entrepreneurship, and anything else.
You going to stay in Austin?
As long as I can.
Any final comments?
Appreciate you for having me, John.
Destin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
One World Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, diversity, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
When all the fears you have are all you can believe, oh, I'll be standing by your side. Just have a little faith in me.
This is One World Radio, an international collaboration between 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, and 89.5 Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa. And our guest today is Brother Chris Sweeney. Brother Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Good to be here.
Now, Brother Chris, before we get into anything, you currently, how you got into everything we're going to talk about today is through your role with the Brothers of the Sacred Heart. For those who don't know, what is the Brothers of the Sacred Heart? And how did you get involved in it?
Well, the Brothers of the Sacred Heart are a religious community of men who take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And I joined out of high school. I went to the Brothers School in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I just felt God calling me to do something different with my life. And after some discernment, I discerned for the priesthood too, but discernment, I really felt called to missionary work as well, which was what led me to spend time in Africa.
I want to get into the thing about how missionary work and spending time in Africa. How did you decide, you'd mentioned you got the calling. What was the moment of you when you really got the calling and was able to say, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life? Because that's a very powerful thing.
Yes, it is. And not many people are responding to that call these days. For me, it was I had gone to a year of college, and during that first year of college, I really started thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. And it was really one day of looking at myself in the mirror and asking myself, what makes you happy? For me, that reality was helping people. I wanted to help people. I really wasn't in this for the money, or you know, all that material success was not important. I said, that's not what makes you happy. I've been around that and I've seen it. And that's not where the key to happiness was. It was helping people. So that's what led me to starting to discern to really ask God what God wanted me to do with my life. And then so I eventually led me to the Brothers who taught me in high school. So I was familiar with them.
And I know there's obviously a big commitment in religious life to helping people and helping others. You spent 12 years in Africa rebuilding a school with three other brothers. What inspired you to do that? And what really came into play when you were going there?
The Brothers were looking to go to a different country in Africa. We had already been in many countries in Africa, including Kenya, Zambia, Zimbabwe. But the brother wanted to open up into a new country. So they asked for volunteers to go into Mozambique and to rebuild a school. We had been asked by a bishop from Mozambique to come and rebuild a school. So I volunteered, and for some reason they chose me, and I was one of four brothers. We had a brother from Zimbabwe, a brother from Brazil, brother from Spain, and myself from the United States, who all went there and with really nothing, started working from day one to rebuild the school, and it's now has 1,300 kids and 200 boarders, and about 50 of those boarders are orphans from the area. I wish I was back there, but unfortunately I had to come back.
Mm-hmm. What really inspired you to say, I know you spoke about helping people and that's what called you to the order, but what really inspired you to say, I'm going to leave everything that I know behind? Because that really is another like big decision. I'm going to leave this all behind and I'm going to go to Africa and I'm going to do this. What really inspired you to do that?
Well, I had always heard stories from the older brothers that I lived with who had been in Africa, especially southern part of the United States. Our brothers had two or three schools in Uganda. That's where I went for about 3 months of my novitiate. Went to work in Uganda. And ever since then, I wanted to get back. And I was always tell my leadership here that I wanted to get back to Africa if the opportunity arose. So it did, and they finally told me, and I volunteered, and we were under direction from our superior general in Rome at the time. So I kind of had to leave the United States and get involved in a whole different area, a whole different culture, obviously. But it was great. I loved it. I loved the simplicity. I loved the life. The people were incredible. And that's what kind of keeps you going day to day, is the people that you meet and people that you work with.
You could just mention for our listeners where they were from again, all the different brothers.
Yeah, we had four brothers there. One from Brazil. He was originally in Canada, but he was a missionary in Brazil, spent 30 years. So he knew the language. Language, by the way, in Mozambique is Portuguese. They speak Portuguese along with their local language. So I had to learn a new language too, which I never was great at, but I tried. So we had the brother from Brazil, brother from Spain. And Portuguese is a little bit closer to Spanish, so he had a little bit easier time with the language. And then our brother from Zimbabwe, the Africans are incredible because they kind of naturally learn different languages, and he picked up Portuguese pretty quickly, actually. So it was us four of us that started there.
How was it with all the different brothers from around the world, kind of from all different places, putting all your cultures together to rebuild this school? And what was that process like?
Yeah, you have to, you don't really forget your culture, but you have to become a part of who you're working with, really. You really become, I won't say you become African, but you live the way they live. I mean, as I said every day, it's more, when you come here, it's more like camping out. Like you would think you're camping out in the United States. This is how we lived every day. We didn't live in mud huts and grass roots, which most of the people in our village lived. We lived in, if you had to pick a poorest part of Mozambique, well, that's where we were. We were in the poorest part of Mozambique, where people lived very simply. Hardly anybody had electricity or running water. So you learn how to deal with that.
See, I couldn't imagine. Lydia, could you imagine no electricity and no running water? Could you imagine that, living in that circumstance?
Crazy enough, we've had a couple of those here in South Africa as well, where we would get blackouts for like 4 hours or up until the next day. And sometimes people short on water. So I kind of understand Brother Chris what he's talking about, actually.
I couldn't imagine. I really couldn't. I mean, we've had power outages in my area, but I really couldn't imagine anything to that extent. Because you were saying you were in the poorest area of Mozambique.
The school that we rebuilt was built back in the 50s by the Franciscans. Although it was still a physical building, there was nothing. Of course, no desks, no doors, no windows. It was just a shell of a building. So we were lucky enough to get help from foundations in Spain. The big one was Manos Unidas, is one of the biggest ones that helped us at least get the funds to do the rebuilding part of it. So once we secured the funds, then we could get to work and start rebuilding. you just take it one day at a time. That's what happens in Mozambique, and I guess in many parts in Africa. You take one day at a time. You deal with all the little problems, and every day there's going to be a problem. Plumbing, whether it's a snake. Mozambique has some of the deadliest snakes in the world. That's the biggest killer in Mozambique are snakes, by the way. Black mamba, green mamba, puff adder, spitting cobras, they're all there, right there in the long grass. So you try to keep the grass cut short and keep the snakes away.
What you were saying regarding that kind of one day at a time, that simple approach to rebuilding something, what was, before you guys got there, with the students that you were bringing in? Because I know you built a girls' dorm, and you had students come in at Parents' Day, and what you had shared with us. What was that really, what was the education system like in this area with these students before you guys got there? Was it strong? Was it not so great? Because you were saying it was one of the poorest areas.
Yeah, before we got there, if you wanted to go to high school, you had to get transportation to in order to go to the next town, which that would cost money. I mean, not a whole lot to us, but it was a lot to them. And very few had money for transportation to go to the school. So there's one thing about Mozambique is that there's no lack of kids. I mean, we had 1,300 kids in the school. We could probably have 2,000. And one of the big differences that I noticed coming back to the United States was just, you know, the kids there really want to really take their education seriously. And there's no behavior problem. They really respect the teacher, whether it's me or whether it's a Mozambican teacher. That part of it is really nice to see, and kind of a big difference between schools here in the United States even.
Why do you think there is more of that appreciation and people like myself? Because like I was saying before, I can't imagine some of these circumstances. Do you think it's because you don't know how good you have it until you don't have it anymore? Do you think it's something along those lines with these students?
Yeah, something like that. And the shocking thing is that really there's not much after high school. I mean, I'd bet about 10% maybe go to college if they can get the money or get a scholarship to go to college. So even though, and their jobs, I mean, unemployment rate is ridiculous. Something like 70% or something. There are no jobs in the area, so. But they still want to be educated. They still want to go through that. I think the parents instill that in them as well, that they need to get an education. And they take it, they take it seriously.
How do you set them up for the next stage of life?
Yeah, there are some trade schools nearby our village, so they would try to get in those, but there's just not enough spaces for all the ones that once was very competitive to get in those places. It's tough. I mean, this is, like I said, this is one of the poorest countries in the world. They're in the top, Mozambique is in the top 10 least developed countries in the world. And there's just no development problems there with corruption, with the health. The health system is something that we can talk about too. They're the worst health system in the world, I think. Which is one of the reasons why I had to leave, because I had malaria. I got malaria more than 30 times while I was there. Two or three times a year I would get malaria. You know, in the United States, we have one doctor for every 270 people. In Mozambique, there's one doctor for every, 20,000 people. They just don't have the doctors. They don't have, even the health system is corrupt. So it's not a good... It's not an easy place to live.
And talking about the country being corrupt and the health system as well. So how was it, like you said, you caught malaria thing. So how do things work on that side when it comes to health?
Yeah, malaria is a big killer in Mozambique, especially to babies and the elderly. They can get the medication, but the problem is, and it's cheap. The problem is there's just not enough of it. When you get malaria, it really just about every instance, when you're talking about health, you're talking about malaria. Whether you have a cold, whether you have the flu, or whether you have any other sickness, you go to get tested and you have malaria, so you got to get rid of the malaria.
And, you know, talking about the healthcare system being corrupt and it is one of the poorest countries in the world. Having to come all over the country to come and build the school, it just shows how the country is, how it needs a lot of help. Like, I want to know, like, what is the education, how was the education system like for the children with disabilities? Because there are children with disabilities and they also need schools. So through your work, were you able to help them out as well?
Yes, I mean, we really tried to hold the teachers accountable. Hardest thing, I think, in Mozambique before we got there was there was very little accountability from the teachers. So unfortunately, the corruption included the education system. Students pay for grades. I hate to say it, but it's true. Students are abused. That goes on. You hear about it from in all other different schools around us. But I mean, with us there and holding teachers accountable and making sure they do what they're supposed to do. This is why more and more students wanted to come to our school, because they knew the teachers were good. And it was just something that we had to instill, and it took years to get it to where it was supposed to be. And it's still got a ways to go. But yeah, it's unfortunate that corruption includes the kids. But, you know, when all you know is corruption and you've had it from elementary school to high school, and then if you become a teacher, you've even had it in college, that's all you know. When the teachers become teachers and that's all you know, then that's how you operate. You just have to learn how to do it in a different way. And that's what it's changing. It's changing, but it's just slowly. It's going to take generations to change it, just because of, like I said, this is how they've learned to operate, and they have to learn differently.
And it will take time, because it's what they know. They were taught. For them, this is normal. Corruption is normal to them.
Correct. You're right.
And I would like to just tap into your story where you embarked on this incredible 6,000-mile bike journey.
From day one, when I was in Mozambique, once we finally got the internet, I would watch almost either a short video on YouTube about people doing bicycle tours in the U.S. and around the world. I said, you know, one day whenever I leave Mozambique, that I'm going to do this. I'm going to go do a bike ride. And I had many other reasons why it would take me a long time to go through all of them. But of course, my nephew with Down syndrome is the one that we raised money for. And that was one of the big reasons, just the realization, because I almost lost my life a few times in Mozambique. So once that happens to you, you know, you look at life a little differently and you kind of realize that, you know, life is short. And if you have something you want to do, you better just go do it. So luckily, the brothers let me ride my bike around the United States. It was an incredible journey.
So while you were traveling across the country on your bike, how long have you been on the road? And like you've mentioned, the journey was beautiful, you know, having people come up to you. How was it?
It's incredible. You know, people can't believe what you're doing. It's like, you're doing what? I said, yeah, so I rode between 50 and 70 miles a day for 5 months. I took a couple of days off here and there when I had a nice place to stay. But for 5 months, getting on the bike every day, it was an incredible experience in all kind of weather. I went through snow. I went through lots of rain, cold, and heat.
And were there any challenges along the way? How did that even happen, you know, having to take just stop and have a place to rest and come back the next day? Did you pack food? How did it go?
One time I spent 6 hours pedaling uphill. 6 hours. So I would stop and walk, take breaks. So I'm kind of a big guy with a heavy bike. So going over mountains was probably the hardest part. But the best thing about getting over the mountains is going downhill. Going 40, 50 miles an hour downhill on the other side.
Because I was going to ask, and you answered my question, you know, it was the people, you know, having to motivate you. Because I was going to ask, how did you stay motivated and keep going?
Yeah, you know, people have asked me that question a lot, and I always tell them, you know, I never doubted, I never thought for a second that I was gonna stop. I was gonna make it all the way, no matter what. It didn't matter. I had to take extra rest days or whatever. I was not gonna stop. I was gonna make it one way or the other. So I had the excitement at the end. I was about 10 miles from the finish line, right outside of San Francisco in Novato, California. My front bracket broke, went in front of me. The wheel caught on that, and I went over the top, and I woke up in an ambulance. 10 miles from the finish, I didn't finish. I ended up in the hospital, but it was okay. Just scratches, bruised. Thankfully, my brother was there to help me. He was going to come pick me up anyway. So I almost made it. I'm 10 miles short, but I almost did it.
I'm shocked. I am shocked. And you kept going. Wow. Yo, that is honestly mind-boggling. And, you know, I'd like to know, you know, through the challenges that you have, what is the thing that you've learned? Anything, something surprising that you've learned about yourself?
Wow. I don't know if I learned anything, because, you know, like I said, we learned this in Mozambique. You know, you learn to take it one day at a time. You just deal with things as they come. I guess I had that so ingrained in my, that's the way I lived all my life almost. I have to tell you, I was born with a club foot and missing nerve down my right leg, so I can't really run or really walk long distances without a great deal of pain, but I can ride a bike. So I've learned all my life, you know, that life's not necessarily fair, that things are going to come up that you deal with, and you get plug along, and God will give you the strength to make it through. All you got to do is try a little bit.
Not only is the bike ride an incredible feat physically because of what you've done, it's going to benefit Ride for Reed, which is trying to open up a coffee shop for your nephew with Down syndrome and other kids with Down syndrome down on the North Shore in New Orleans, so that they can be sent, have a job, and go work when they get out of school. Tell everybody a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we're still working on trying to get that open, but it's definitely going to happen one day. There are these shops, the coffee shops. They serve a little food, cafes, kind of places all over the country, but there's nothing like that where we are. So really all the people that are in the shop, in the cafe, are special needs young people. We realize that if you go online, you can see a number of videos of these places.
And I'd like to know, through your whole journey with the 6,000 miles bike ride, and the things that you've done throughout your whole life, like what kind of impact do you hope, you know, all of this will have on people, you know, especially with people who may not be familiar with Down syndrome?
I never really thought about what I wanted the impact to be. I mean, in your life, and it's all about what God calls you to do, and you respond to that the best you can. It ends up being your life is not about you. Your life is about helping others. When you have that, you've learned that lesson. And that's one thing that Down syndrome kids teach you. As I say when I'm around Reed, you can't stop smiling. When you're around Reed, the most happy, the most joyous kid in the world. Reed is someone who, fortunately, he has no other physical issues, physical problems, except that he has not started talking clearly. He just kind of grunts, you know. He's slowly learning some words and starting to talk, and he's 10 years old now, almost 11. Even though he can't talk, he loves to dance, loves to hug, he loves to play around. He will make you smile. If you don't smile around him, you're never going to smile. And that's what they teach us. So I guess if I could have anybody learn anything from my experiences, it would be just that, just to learn to live life one day at a time and do what God wants you to do, not necessarily what you want to do, and make people happy. As Mother Teresa says, someone asked her, Mother Teresa, how to change the world. He said, well, you change the world by going to love your family in your own house. That's how you change the world.
One World Radio, an international collaboration that highlights the power of community radio across the globe. Every Tuesday at 4 p.m. right here on 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio Hofstra University.
89.5 FM.
Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa. And today, ICN in New York. Tony, thank you very much for coming on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for looking out for us. And today we're about to share a real special moment together. Thank you.
A real special moment indeed. Now, Tony, what I wanted to get into first is you mentioned before the broadcast that ICN has been broadcasting for 40 years. Tell me about the history of ICN, the Italian Communication Network.
Yeah, well, Italian Communication Network starts early 80s. Grazie San Pameri with this vision of bringing an Italian program, a radio program, broadcasting every day. And back in those days, you know, it wasn't like today where you have so much of Italy in one way or another. So having a radio to listen to every day was really connection with the community in what the radio does, you know, representing the community, promoting the community, informing the community, and entertainment, obviously. And so it started out with the need an Italian radio present every day in the tri-state area.
So that's how it started. It started back in what year, Tony? What year did it start up?
1983, 1984. So we're in our 41st year.
So obviously you wanted to educate and inspire the community and do things with that, the Italian-American community. What really, obviously everyone wants to really motivate their community to shine, be the best that it can be. What really was ICN? How did it start? It obviously had to start off small. Tell us about how it built up through the years.
It started with, like I said, South America was the founder of this radio. Okay. And, you know, he started broadcasting daily. He used to do a news report. He used to talk about the community, inform the community, you know, play music, obviously, sports, which was very important.
Hey, everyone. This is DJ Chris Wired. Breakfast for Dinner is off this week. I will be back next week with a new show. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this, and thanks for listening.
The vast majority still of people who can make a difference in this country in affecting American policy towards Palestine, the vast majority of the people are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge today. You can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. A myth is a story passed down through generations that attempts to explain the origins of something. The foundational myth of Israel is a land without people for a people without a land. That myth had profound consequences that reverberate today. There were people there, the Palestinians. Such myths are characteristic of settler colonial societies such as South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. Sure, there were a few primitive savages, but they had to give way to superior beings. John Kennedy famously said, quote, "We stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West." Kennedy did not mention the great indigenous nations that were slaughtered by the colonizers. We must deconstruct the myths and reveal the realities behind them. Our guest today is Ilan Pappe. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa and was chair of the Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies in Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Gaza in Crisis, 10 Myths About Israel, and Lobbying for Zionism. During the course of his presentation, he mentions that he was detained and questioned for 2 hours by federal agents at the Detroit airport when he came to the United States. He was asked before being released about his views on Hamas, Gaza, genocide, and Israel. He spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. And now, Ilan Pappe, Myths of Israel.
Thank you all for being here. It feels a bit surreal to talk about history at a time when we are all gathered here to think together how to stop the genocide in Gaza and the one that is developing in the West Bank, and how to strategize or help to strategize for the liberation of Palestine. But as I think many of you are aware, the history of the Zionist project in Palestine is a very important entry point for understanding the situation today and for discussing the future. And once we are thinking of extending the network of support for Palestine beyond our usual suspects, beyond the people we have worked for so many years together in the solidarity movement, we still, I'm sure, are aware, about the level of ignorance and misinformation and mythologies that are connected to the way the mainstream media in this country and in the global north in general reports the history of Palestine, the situation in Palestine, and as well as in some very important academic centers, still in courses and modules across the academia in the global north, still the way the history is being told plays an important role in the immunity that Israel is granted by the global north, and particularly by the United States, for its criminal policies on the ground. And it's not enough to defy or even defeat the misinformation and fabrication that goes along with the historical narrative that are being spent in, by the media or by the academia by soundbites. The machinery that produces these misinformed, misguided, and fabricated narratives is a very sophisticated one and includes a lot of important academics and journalists and wordsmiths, people who know how to write and how to talk and how to preach. In order to challenge them successfully, we need to understand the history of the place of the Zionist movement, of the Zionist project, in a profound way, through proper research, through professional historiography, and with the help of those who decided to devote their life for that kind of research and activity. So I think that their interaction, which was always very important in the left, between academics or intellectuals, educators, and activists, is something which is highly important for the success of expanding the network of solidarity with Palestine and contributing be it a modest contribution to the liberation of Palestine and the decolonization of historical Palestine. The 10 Myths of Israel, the book itself, was actually born out of this rather frustrating engagement I had, not with people in the solidarity movement with Palestine, but whenever I try to expand my dialogue beyond those who are committed or have been committed strongly to Palestine. Whenever you try to expand the network to try and say, I will talk with some people who seem to be reasonable, educated, have a modicum of decency in them, whose positions on other social and political issues you respect. In fact, some of them are your mentors in certain areas of study or human activity. You encounter this very solid narrative of why there is a conflict in Palestine, what is its origins, why is